You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, March 28th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, folks. I am on vacation. Matt and Michael are on vacation. No one's in the office yet. Yet, we are bringing to you all new material. You've never heard it before. We've never played it on this program. And most of it's never been heard anywhere, except for in the confines of my own home. Today on the program, Stephen Brill, the author he's written a couple of pieces. He's also a huge entrepreneur who founded Court TV. He wrote a piece on education that I wasn't terribly in agreement with, but this piece that he has done for Time magazine on what is the driver of medical costs in this country is a blockbuster piece, and it's going to have a real big implications, I think, on the national discourse. And he goes further in this interview than he did in his piece in terms of offering solutions. And it's been reported that he has sort of accepted this perspective about single payer. But he talks about it in this interview that I did with him, in part for Ring of Fire, but the full interview I did for just this program. And then I followed it up with an interview I did with James Kimmy from Families USA that I did several months ago. He's a former hospital executive. And he outlines many of the same things that Stephen Brill reported on, but obviously from the perspective of somebody who works at a hospital. So if you want to know what is the number one driver of medical costs in this country, listen to these two interviews. If you want to know what is the number one driver of our debt and our supposed unfunded obligations going on in the future, listen to this interview. This is really important stuff. About if you're interested in debt, deficit, those issues, if you're interested in healthcare, those issues, this is important, important stuff. So stick around, enjoy it, all new material. Tomorrow on the program, we will be off again, but we'll have some new material, some archive material for you. And then on Monday of next week, we will play on the, 9th anniversary of the launch of Air America Radio and the first Majority Report. We will play the first Majority Report ever on Air America, I suppose, with Janine and I. I did one before that, but you don't need to hear this now. And I don't need to say it because I'm trying to get away. I'm trying to go on vacation. So enjoy today's interviews. Stephen Brill, James Kimmy, and we'll have a program for you tomorrow.
So, Stephen, this the piece that you wrote in Time, it's a both getting a lot of attention, both in terms of the its implications in the media, which we won't touch because for the sake of time. But the content of the piece is it's one of the few in-depth analyses that we've seen, at least in outside of small policy circles, into the problems that are facing this country in terms of medical expenses. And it's particularly relevant right now as we hear a lot of talk in Washington about forging some type of grand bargain based upon notions of the debt. And the debt is going to be going into the future very much driven by the costs of health care. But that's generally where people end the discussion. And you decided to look at why health care is so expensive in this country. What made you decide to do that?
Well, for exactly the reason you outlined, which is we have these endless debates about who should pay for the exorbitant cost of healthcare without stopping and saying, hey, how come it costs so much? You know, who's getting all the money? Now, it could have had a whole bunch of very innocent reasons. It could have been because our healthcare in America is so much better than everybody else's healthcare. Turns out that's not true. Our results aren't any better. It could have been because everybody is working very hard and just really scraping by, and the profits aren't that high, and it's just a fact of life. Turns out that's definitely not true. It turns out that our favorite local institution, the local nonprofit hospital, is exorbitantly profitable, with the CEOs and other non-doctors administrators making tons of money. It could have turned out that the drug companies really need to charge what they charge because it costs them so much to develop drugs. Turns out that's not true. It's just, the bottom line is that we've been living in two economies in this country. There's the economy that you and I and most other people live in, which has been pretty hard-pressed for the last half decade. High unemployment, people's incomes are squeezed, people's budgets are squeezed, and things have been pretty tough. And then there's the healthcare economy, which has been total boom times for the last 5 and 10 years, where everybody's making more and more money every day, and it's almost like they live in an alternate universe. And the reason they do is that they're completely unaffected by the marketplace. Healthcare is not a free market.
Now, let's get into the reasons why that's the case, because one of the arguments that we hear in terms of solving the spiraling costs of healthcare in this country is that consumers don't, or rather that patients should be able to be empowered to function more like consumers, that if there was some transparency or if there was an opportunity for them to actually have some so-called skin in the game and pay directly for their medical costs, that they would become more informed shoppers like one would if you're buying a stereo, I guess. Now, tell us why that doesn't work.
Well, it might help a little bit at the margins, but the fact is if you walk into a store to buy a stereo and you're looking in in the window and you see this a stereo and it looks nice and you figure, oh, that's going to cost me $600-$700, and you walk in and the guy behind the counter says, well, actually, that's $8,000. You have a choice right there. You can turn around and walk out of the store and not buy it. Also, you can walk out of the store and go to your left and walk up the block and go to another music store and look at a competing price. Now think of what happens when you show up at the emergency room at a hospital. You don't know what you're buying. You have no idea what the cost is. You just know you've shown up at the emergency room, which means you must need medical care, and you're not exactly going to, go to 6 emergency rooms to figure out who's got the best price, because you don't even know what it is you're buying, and you wouldn't have any idea of what the quality is. And it's not just emergency rooms. It's prescription drugs. It's your doctor saying that you need a CAT scan, and he says, you should go to this clinic for the CAT scan. And, you could become a better shopper for CAT scans if you went online, but you're not likely to, because your doctor has told you this is the place to go and you need this CAT scan. So the medical marketplace, is nothing like any other marketplace in our country, because for starters, you're not choosing to buy something. You don't wake up in the morning and say, the way you would, I'd like to buy a new music system. You don't wake up in the morning and say, I think I'll go down to the emergency room today and see what they have on sale.
So we've determined that really making a patient a sort of a better consumer is simply not really possible.
It could help at the margins, but the simple fact is that, you know, when you hear people say, well, patients should have more skin in the game, that's certainly true if you're paying, you know, 1% of the cost because you're so heavily insured, but that doesn't happen very much anymore. And second, we tried the experiment with patients having more skin in the game. There are 30, 40, 50 million patients in the United States who don't have any insurance at all.
Right.
And they have total skin in the game. And, you know, how's that working out?
So you basically spent 2 years, my understanding.
Six months.
Doing an incredible amount of legwork, chasing down essentially people's hospital bills to get a sense on a line-by-line basis of what are they being charged for and why they're being charged so much for it. Just give us a sense of the typical bill that you took a look at.
Well, what I did was I followed the money. If you want to understand why something costs so much, the best thing to do is to just take it apart and see how much each element costs and who's making what kind of profit or who's losing money and figure out why the cost has to be what it is. And so I took some hospital bills, also some outpatient clinic bills, and just line by line, you know, traced the cost. Now, it's difficult because hospital bills are in codes. They have all these numerical codes and acronyms. But, you know, when I decoded the first line on my first bill, it turns out it was for a generic version of a Tylenol pill. And it was for $1.50, which doesn't sound like much until you realize you can go on Amazon and buy 100 of them for $1.50. The next item was a blood test or a CAT scan. And when you decoded it and looked at what Medicare pays, which is the only really efficient buyer of health care in the country, what Medicare pays was something like, you know, 1/12 of what this patient was being asked to pay up front, who didn't have adequate insurance.
And so it turns out that there is you found that there is something called, I guess it's the Charge Master. And
right. And
tell us
every,
what that is.
The Charge Master is a hospital's, you know, basically its price list. It's an internal document. It's now a computerized, you know, document that has every item ranging from the $1.50 for the Tylenol pill to, in one case, to $13,000 per dose for a cancer drug. And when you trace back the cancer drug, what I found was the hospital was charging this patient, you know, the $13,000. The hospital was paying about $4,000. The drug company was paying a few hundred dollars to sell it to the hospital for $400. The drug company's CEO had been making, you know, $5 or $10 million a year, going up, you know, 10 or 15% a year during the time that the rest of us were in this, you know, hard pressed half decade. And everybody was doing really well except for the cancer patient.
All right, we need to take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about why it is that Medicaid ends up paying less than a private insurer might, and why a private insurer might pay less than someone without insurance, and try and make some sense of this, and then talk perhaps as to what your story leads us to conclude in terms of the only way to bring down the cost of healthcare in this country. We'll be right back after this. So, Stephen, in the last segment, you were telling us about the reporting that you've done for this blockbuster story in Time magazine, which outlines the way prices are inflated in this country for medicine, essentially, and the really irrational, I don't know what better way of saying it, of system of patients being charged, and really the fact that the cost of healthcare in this country is a function of who pays at a given point. So, I mean, is that a fairly accurate?
Sure. Medicare pays the least because Medicare is the only buyer in the marketplace that has real buying power because it's so big. So it negotiates certain fees with hospitals and doctors, and it can't. Congress doesn't let it negotiate what it pays for, you know, medical devices, whether they're canes or defibrillators or, you know, anything in between. And because of that, Medicare overpays to the tune of $20 or $25 million because Congress doesn't let Medicare do competitive bidding for that. But so if you want to cut the deficit over 10 years, there's an extra $250 billion right there if Congress wasn't lobbied so much by all these device makers and everybody. But to come back to your question.
We have the same dynamic, I should say, as well with prescription drugs.
Exactly, in terms of Medicare Part D. So in terms of hospital care or hospital charges, Medicare does negotiate. No hospital has to take a Medicare patient. They all do. And typically those what Congress mandates Medicare do is pay the actual cost to the hospital of providing that service, including overhead such as the physical plant and the salaries of the administrators and everything else, take the actual cost of providing that service, because Medicare actually takes seriously the idea that, guess what, nonprofit hospitals are supposed to be nonprofit. Now, insurance companies basically pay a premium over what Medicare pays. They may pay 30, 40, 50% more than Medicare. How much they pay depends on their bargaining power. And as the article points out, insurance companies have increasingly less leverage because all over the country, hospitals are consolidating. They're buying up other hospitals. They're buying up medical practices so that if an insurance company, for example, wants to sell health insurance in Oklahoma City, it better have the Mercy Hospital in their network. So Mercy Hospital can drive a really hard bargain with that insurance company and charge significantly more than it charges Medicare. Then at the bottom of the food chain are people who don't have insurance or whose insurance is so meager and they're out of network that the hospital doesn't even recognize it, and those are the people who get charged the charge master rate. So that, let's say you have a blood test. You might pay, $240 for the blood test at Bridgeport Hospital if you don't have insurance. You might pay $60 for the blood test if you have insurance and it's in-network at that hospital. Or the insurance company might pay $60. And Medicare might pay $13. So you have this perverse situation where the people least able to afford anything, the individuals who don't have insurance, are charged the most, and they get sued if they can't pay.
And when we talk about the buying power of Medicare, is part of it, is there a distinction between the volume of medical care that Medicare and Medicaid purchases versus the amount of data that is available for Medicare in terms of the efficacy and how much something should cost? I mean, in other words...
Well, it's a combination of both. Medicare uses the data to determine what it'll pay. And hospitals have to supply all their cost data to the Department of Health and Human Services, and Medicare crunches all those numbers. And there'll be an allowance for a certain hospital if it's in a higher cost of living area, if their rent is higher, but basically they take the core costs and then add things on. Did they spend a lot of money, educating and training young doctors? That'll get added, onto the cost too. So now the hospitals complain that they lose money on Medicare, but the simple fact is, as I pointed out in the article, that hospitals, for example, in Florida, advertise like crazy for Medicare patients. So you wouldn't advertise for patients if you were losing money. Medicare pays very efficiently and very quickly, and 94% of all the doctors in this country and all the hospitals take Medicare.
So why doesn't the private insurance industry, why don't they use those Medicare numbers? I mean,
the hospital says, we're not going to give you those prices. So, if you're an insurer in the New Haven, Connecticut area, if you want to sell health insurance in the New Haven, Connecticut area, what do you do if Yale New Haven, which recently bought the only other hospital in New Haven, says, we're not going to be in your network because you won't pay us enough?
And that's it. You're completely out of luck.
Free market. Don't you believe in free markets? It's free market.
Indeed. And so, I mean, as a consumer of healthcare, the Medicare makes the most sense because it is because of its purchasing power.
And it's also operated much more efficiently than the insurance companies. Their payment systems are better. They're not only more efficient, but they catch missed billings more efficiently. You know, you think of your insurance company as the place where, you know, if you send in a claim for $58, you know, they can test it and send you back, you know, $42. That's true. But the other side of that coin is that I found all kinds of instances where insurance companies were dramatically overpaying because their systems were just so much less efficient than the Medicare system.
And yet private insurance is a fairly lucrative industry.
It's a big business, the high volume, relatively low profit margins, but they're really just, you know, processing paper. But they're not very good at negotiating with, you know, with doctors and hospitals, and they're increasingly losing their leverage because, again, if a hospital buys up all the doctor's practices in that community, and you're an insurance company, you need those doctors and that hospital in your network.
Well, it's an incredibly fascinating analysis, particularly going forward when we're talking so much about how to control medical costs. With that said, your piece almost, it seems to me, very deliberately does not address a solution per se. It seems to walk us up to it. And I've seen in other venues that you've talked about perceiving a Medicare for all type of system as really the best solution that we have.
Well, yeah. I mean, when I was doing the reporting, there were sort of two things going on at once. One was, I very much didn't want the reporting to be overshadowed by me mounting, you know, a political platform either from the right or the left, espousing, you know, a complete solution. I wanted the reporting to speak for itself. The second reason was, I really, you know, I'm totally new to this stuff, and I really hadn't been able to think through all the policy ramifications of all this the way people who've been working on this for 5 or 10 or 20 years have, and I didn't want to presume to. Since the piece has been published, I've read a lot of the critiques of the policy stuff I do at the end of the article where I sort of suggest, you know, some kinds of solutions. And I think those critiques, a lot of them are correct, and I've learned a lot from them. And I think that it's pretty clear to me that you can't mythologize a marketplace solution for the healthcare economy, because again, the buyer has so much less power than the seller. I think you do need some kind of, you know, government-imposed solution. And when I say that, I also say that from the backdrop of, you know, every other developed country in the world has exactly that. We're the only ones who've made the choice to do what we do, and the results are we spend much more per person and get results that aren't as good. So you can make the argument that if you allowed everyone to enroll in Medicare and pay a higher premium than people who are 65 pay, even though their costs would be lower because if they're younger, just demographically, they're likely to be healthier, that would be a good cost solution. And if insurance companies and, you know, private, you know, HMOs or health maintenance organizations want to compete with Medicare for that, that would be great.
And we see across, not only do we in this country pay more per capita in terms of what our government pays, we pay double the costs as it is. So we pay both more, our government pays more, and we also pay more as individuals.
Sure. You know, you remember from the days when, you know, the auto companies were in such terrible shape, you know, people were saying that there's $1,000 or $2,000 in every car related to health care costs. Well, that's still true. You know, we've cleaned up a lot else in the automotive industry, but that disadvantage is still there. And again, it's not like our workers are getting better health care than workers are getting in, you know, the countries they compete with.
And I think one of the things it's been, and I know you've got just a couple minutes here, but one of the things that I think has sort of reinforced your reporting is that we're now finding, at least over the past couple of years, that the cost of Medicare and Medicaid has begun to, the rate of increase has begun to level off significantly. And no one seems quite sure exactly why. Do you have any hunches as to why that's the case?
Well, part of the Affordable Care Act, the Obama reforms, gave Medicare a little more leverage in being able to save some money, assess some penalties against hospitals for bad events and reward them for good events. But it's also, I think, in large part because, as a general matter, the economy just hasn't been as good. I think that's why overall health care costs have started to not level out, but not increase as quickly as they were before.
And part of that, I think, just to get your take on that, is also that there has been a tremendous amount of drugs that have come off of patent
over the past couple of years. There's a story this week in the Times about that. That's helped a lot. But again, if you really want to help deal with the cost of drugs, allow Medicare to do something other than be forced to pay whatever the drug company wants to charge them.
Right. And you talk about the tremendous lobbying. Will you just cover that just for a moment? Because I think people really need to put this in relief. We talk about the military-industrial complex in this country, but their lobbying spending is a fraction of what we see
The military-industrial complex are basically, homeless people compared to the healthcare industry when it comes to Washington. The healthcare industry spends something like four times as much as they do than the oil and gas interests. The people you think is the big bad lobbyists are, under-resourced compared to the combination of the hospital lobby, the medical device lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, the health insurance lobby, you name it. And that's why Obamacare passed, because it didn't impinge on the profits of any of those big interests. Obamacare is really about, who should pay and who should get what insurance, not about how come it costs so much.
Right. I hope that your piece goes a long way to opening up another front on that argument on how we can control medical costs. And also, I think, to explicate to people that the issue when we talk about the cost of Medicare and Medicaid is not a function of the program, but rather what the program pays for.
Right. It's a function of the underlying economy, which is a an artificial, non-competitive monopoly economy.
Well, this piece should certainly, in my estimation, affect the conversations we're seeing in Washington right now about the debt and deficit. But hope springs eternal. Stephen Brill, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
We are back, continuing our coverage of Families USA Health Action 2013. With me now, Dr. James R. Kimmy. He is a professor emeritus and executive in residence at St. Louis University College for Public Health and Social Justice. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So let me, we're talking quite a bit about the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, a lot of people here, a lot of people advocating for Medicaid expansion and working on the exchanges and whatnot. Let me ask you a slightly different question. Maybe and perhaps this is in your wheelhouse or not, but okay. Talk to me about what your perception is with the problem with healthcare delivery. Not so much necessarily from an insurance standpoint, but why it is that we have such extraordinarily runaway healthcare costs in this country.
I think it comes from a number of factors. Part of it is certainly comes from the idea that healthcare is a commodity and that we can somehow treat it like we treat other commodities. It's not. You know, you can choose to buy a banana, but you can't choose the time you get sick. And so as long as you do that, then it creates an environment in which you have tremendous profitability in the healthcare industry. And you can look at, you know, any component of it, whether it's medical delivery, hospitals, insurance, pharmaceuticals. They're all organized as businesses for the most part, and they're all pretty remunerative. Even nonprofit hospitals have to make a margin, and they do make margins, and some of them are pretty impressive margins. And so I think that, you know, when you talk about controlling costs, you're really talking about a holistic approach, if you will. You can't control costs by saying certain class of physicians make too much, so we're going to put a limit on that. Or our hospitals are charging too much, so we're going to put a limit on it. It doesn't work that way. You've got to look at this whole spectrum of contributors to cost and say, what's their contribution to cost, and what's their contribution going to be to the solution?
And so, I mean, it sounds to me like we almost need a cultural overhaul in the way that we deliver and administer healthcare.
Sure. I think that, you know, there's several things in the culture that contribute to the cost. Television advertising and pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, who would take the things if they listen to the warnings that that little fast voice says, this will, you know, cause your teeth to fall out and your hair to fall out and you'll drop dead. But that drives up costs because people do go in and ask for those high-cost legend drugs rather than accepting that, you know, there are generics that are just as effective, or maybe you really don't need that medicine at all.
Changes
maybe if you change your diet,
right,
you'd be a lot better off. But people don't want to hear that. And so there's a demand drive in the healthcare industry. Then it comes around the services. It comes around people saying, you know, whatever it is, if it can be done, I want it. And it may not be appropriate, but you'll get it.
And is that because of the incentives that also drive the doctors, or is it? Let me ask you this: is it possible with the system that we have now to control these costs?
No, I think we, you know, I think there are major changes that we need to make in the way that we organize and deliver the services. Now, a lot of those are incorporated in the Affordable Care Act, at least as demonstrations. Patient-centered medical homes, accountable care organizations, and then a variety of other things in there. A lot of funding for studies of efficacy of treatment and the development of standards that can be applied in the insurance program. So there are a lot of things happening out there, but the commitment to really taking them from the lab into everyday practice is not that strong.
And is there a mechanism even to do that? I mean, in a wholesale way? I mean, it seems to me that there might be opportunities here and there to take those experiments and expand upon them, but there's so many players. I wonder if we can, with, you know, our mechanism for paying for it still remains not a single payer mechanism.
That's right.
And so presumably it's much easier. I mean, I've never met anybody who didn't say it's much easier to control costs with a single payer because you take those experiments and you can actually apply them.
You can apply them, sure. You know, healthcare has been described as a cottage industry. That's not adequate to healthcare. Healthcare is a resort industry. And so, you know, you've got this big resort or combination of resorts, and you want to change something over here, and they say, well, we change it, but they won't change theirs, and that's going to cost us patients or dollars or whatever. See, I used to run a big university hospital, and one day the local newspaper ran an article that said we charged $2,500 for a bunionectomy, and all the other hospitals in town are much lower. And so the staff meeting, I said, what is this? And they said, well, we don't really get that. I said, what do you, well, we get $800 from this insurance company, and we get $450 from this one, and we get about $1,000 from this one. I said, well, why aren't we telling the newspaper what we're really getting? Because then everyone would want that.
Right.
You see, and that you wouldn't run a business that way. You would.
So, in other words, the hospital sets the price of a procedure, but they get what they get
from the insurance companies. Negotiated.
And it actually, they'll end up charging some people who are uninsured more. Is that right?
Book value, or whatever they call it in the hotel industry. Rack rate. Yeah, it, you know, there's a price, and then there's what you really get. And the thing is that for any, most given procedures, there are many different, you receive many different amounts depending on the insurance company and the deal that they've negotiated with your hospital.
Uh-huh. And if you have no deal because you have no insurance company, you're actually in a worse position.
You're in a worse position, but most hospitals will negotiate.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you. Now that you're emeritus, people can obviously negotiate for their health care. Is that right? I mean, just saying those words, the proposition is stunning, because when we talk about negotiation, we think, like, I can't even go in. Yeah, I can negotiate for the bottle of water I buy at a kiosk on the street. People do that. I've seen it. It had never even occurred to me that you could. You negotiate for a car. But the idea that you can go in and negotiate for your cancer treatment or for your bunionectomy, it's stunning.
Well, but it's usually negotiation after the fact, because the system does provide the services. And it's when they come back at you to collect that, and you don't have insurance, let's say, and they say, well, you have this little bill for $122,000 for a procedure, and you say, well, I can't do that. They say, well, how does 80?
Right.
It's negotiation.
So, and from the insurance company's perspective, let me, if I got to presume that insurance company A knows that insurance company B is paying for that bunionectomy $200 less. I got to presume that they have their means in figuring out. But what the hospital is going to negotiate differently with insurance company A than B because of the risk pool that insurance company A has. And they may have other procedures that are more expensive. Right. Is that basically the way it works?
That certainly is one part of it. But I think the other is that, you know, the insurance company wants to get the service at the lowest rate possible. The hospital wants to sell the service at the highest rate possible. And that's, you know, that's ideal grounds for negotiation. Do they do risk adjustment in this? Sure. You do look at the pool of patients that a given insurer is going to bring to the table. But these price variations, they're not all from that. They're just from this crazy negotiating process.
And so it could be just more of a function of, like, that guy comes by and he brings me lunch on Thursdays. And so is that, I mean,
does the Fifth Amendment apply in radio? I used to run a hospital. I don't think I want to talk about that.
Well, I mean, but
you're right. You're right. Personal relationships.
I know there's a problem with drugs.
The usual stuff that happens in business relationships happens in health business relationships.
Right.
They're not that different.
Interesting. And because otherwise we would see probably one or two insurance companies specifically doing this so well that their costs are substantially lower than other insurance companies. Yep. But we don't really see that, do we?
No, you don't really see that. And you don't really see the insurance. Well, you've. In the negotiating process, you will see an insurer and a hospital say, we're not going to do business with each other anymore. And then the people who have that insurance say, but we love that hospital. And the people, you know, and it becomes a part of the drama around the negotiation. And at the end of the day, they do business.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it's stunning when you perceive that this is something about health and not cable TV.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to say, I'm no longer going to have access to ESPN Classics because they're having a fight with...
I didn't design it, and I don't defend it. It's a crazy system. It's got to change, and you're probably, your earlier statement, single payer is probably the one thing that'll change it.
Well, Dr. James Kimmy, I appreciate your expertise and your insights on this, and thanks for explaining some of this stuff to us. It's a little bit upsetting, but I guess you got to take your medicine, right, to maintain the medicine.
It's been upsetting me for 50 years.
So I can imagine.
You're new to it.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.